And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I just started last week titled Jack's New Power Stories from a Caribbean Year. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Princess Arabella is a Big Sister. Beatrice Bly's Rules for Spies, Mystery Goo. And then it's The Big Wig Parade. This Land, The History of the Land We're On. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with, hopefully, The Scarecrow. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book, which is titled, Princess Arabella is a Big Sister. Princess Arabella is playing with her ball. She throws it into the air and bounces it up and down. She shakes her curly head. It's a bit boring, she thinks, playing by myself all the time. Wouldn't it be nicer to have a little brother or a little sister, someone you could always play with? Mom, Dad, I don't want to be an only child anymore. Can you get a little brother or sister for me tomorrow? Then we can play together. The king and queen smile and ask, which would you prefer, a little brother or a little sister? Well, that's a hard question, thinks Princess Arabella. A little brother or a little sister? They both sound like good fun. A few days later, Princess Arabella is visiting Prince Mimon and his sister, Princess Layla. Mimon's mom hands out sweets. Yum, yum. It's really nice having a little sister around, thinks Arabella. Suddenly, Princess Layla grabs some of her brother's sweets. You've got more than me, she yells. I haven't. Give them back, screams Mimon. All of the sweets fall onto the floor. Maybe a little brother would be better, thinks Princess Arabella. A few weeks later, Arabella goes to play with Princess Ling and her three little brothers. They decide to do a jigsaw puzzle with 100 pieces. Now there's just one last piece missing. They can't find the last jigsaw puzzle piece. I can see it! I can see it! Cries Princess Ling. So now I can put in the last piece. No! The three brothers all shout together. We want to do it! They run towards the last piece, and one of them slips and falls right on top of the puzzle. Now the puzzle is in 100 pieces again. I wish I didn't have little brothers, yells Ling. Maybe I should ask for a big sister instead, Arabella thinks to herself. A couple of months later, Princess Arabella is playing dress-up at Princess Sophie's house. Your big sister always wears such pretty dresses, says Arabella with a sigh. Why don't we try them on, says Princess Sophie. Shouldn't we ask her first, replies Arabella. But Sophie is already diving into Princess Stella's wardrobe. Princess Arabella and Princess Sophie admire themselves in the mirror. These dresses are so much prettier than the things in the dressing-up box. But then Princess Stella storms into the room. What are you doing with my clothes? She shouts. Mom, Sophie's playing with my things again. It's another couple of months later now. Princess Arabella still isn't sure. Would she prefer a little sister or a little brother? Actually, being an only child is pretty good, thinks Princess Arabella. The next morning, Princess Arabella's dad, the king, wakes her up. Wake up, Arabella, wake up. It's time. Come and see. With sleepy eyes, Princess Arabella goes into her mom and dad's bedroom. Look, sweetheart, says the queen, a little brother and a little sister. Congratulations, Arabella. You're a big sister now. Beatrice Bly's Rules for Spies. Mystery Goo. Beatrice Bly's first spy mission had to be a success. She was feeling confident and restless, because any good spy knows there is always another mission brewing. She added to her list of rules. Super spy rules. Expect the unexpected. Exercise regularly. Spies are always on the move. Have a backup plan. Spy work is unpredictable. One morning at school, Miss Leland made an announcement. Okay, students, it's time to choose partners and projects for the upcoming science fair. More like science unfair, muttered Beatrice. This is going to cut into my spying time. Fair or not, said Nora, we have a project to do. Right, partner? Right, grumbled Beatrice. If you've already chosen a partner, said Miss Leland, raise your hand. Beatrice started to lift her arm, but it stuck to the table. Ooh, she said, sticky. Maybe something spilled, said Nora. Probably by a messy kid, but why this table? Coincidence? There are no coincidences. Beatrice pulled out her magnifying glass and inspected the spot. Someone is behind this. Maybe it's just a sticky table, said Nora. Maybe it's my new mission, whispered Beatrice. Collect a sample. Here we go again, Nora sighed, then scraped the goo off the table and into a snack container. At snack time, Beatrice and Nora watched for messy classmates and thought of sticky substances. Lucy's lunch bag leaks, said Nora. Spencer brings fruit gummies, added Beatrice. Could it be glue, suggested Nora. Or hand sanitizer, said Beatrice. Beatrice got out her notebook and the pair wrote down goo possibilities. Gummies, juice, glue, hand sanitizer. We'll need samples, said Beatrice. Class, please clean up, Miss Leland said. Then follow me outside for recess. Beatrice and Nora waited. When the last student left the classroom, Beatrice tiptoed to the trash can and used her Grabbit 3000 to pluck the evidence from the bin. Did you get it? Asked Nora. Affirmative. And Spencer's wrapper still had a gummy stuck to the bottom. On their way to recess, Nora popped into the art room for glue. Beatrice opened the janitor's closet and borrowed a bottle of hand sanitizer. We can look at them under my microscope tonight and compare them to the goo, Nora suggested. That evening, Beatrice and Nora examined bits of each sticky sample. I think I see sugar molecules in the goo, said Nora. The hand sanitizer has tiny circles, said Beatrice, when it was her turn. It's runny, though, not sticky. And Lucy's juice is purple, not gold like the goo. They looked at the gummy. Oh, said Nora, it's too solid. Not gooey enough. Well, we tried. Beatrice sniffed the goo. Smells sweet. I have an idea. For the science fair? Asked Nora. For the backup plan. I think it's time to abandon the mission, said Nora. Good spies never leave a mission unfinished. But it seems we're not getting anywhere. Nora, not everything is what it seems. The next day, Beatrice said, my spy hunch tells me we missed something. Maybe the goo was already inside the classroom. Let's check again. Nora crossed her arms. Nope. I promise after we do one last inspection, we'll work on our science fair project, pleaded Beatrice. So Nora agreed. Beatrice grabbed her spy backpack and they snuck into the classroom to investigate. Nora stood watch. I don't understand, said Beatrice. I just can't seem to find the source of the... They looked up. Goo! They shouted. And there it is, stuck on top of the ceiling. I need to get up there, said Beatrice. Can't quite reach. Hurry, said Nora. Principal Lewis is coming. Beatrice scampered down just in time. Shouldn't you girls be outside? Asked Principal Lewis. On our way. Wow, we were so close, said Beatrice. What if the roof is melting? What if it's alien goo? If only there was a way to see into the ceiling. Could you look in the air vent from here? Nora asked. Great thinking. I'll use my extendable spioscope. Beatrice stretched. She did jumping jacks. What are you doing? Asked Nora. Exercising. Spies need to be nimble. Beatrice climbed. She balanced. She positioned her spioscope in the vent. See anything? Asked Nora. No. Wait a minute. Bees! Beatrice shouted, scrambling down. Know what else is sticky? Asked Beatrice. Honey, which has sugar molecules. And we've already collected, analyzed, and compared our sample. Beatrice, do you know what this means? They looked at each other. Our science fair project? Lucky for us, said Nora. There's a lot of science in spying. Beatrice grinned. Now that's fair. The next day, Miss Leland held class outside while the bee rescuers safely removed the hive. Why did the bees go in the ceiling? Said Lucy. What will happen to them now? Said Spencer. Oh, they'll be fine, the beekeeper explained. Bees like dry, well-ventilated places, so the school air vent seemed like a perfect home to them. We have the queen, so once we introduce the bees to a new hive, they'll team up and get right back to work. The next week, Nora and Beatrice's display was the buzz of the science fair, and it's titled, Honey, the Bee's Knees. Honey and a first place ribbon, said Nora, giving Beatrice a high five. You're a pretty sweet spy, Beatrice. No, said Beatrice. I'm a super spy, and you are one super partner. The Big Wig Parade. And keep in mind, all of these are dogs. Woogums, I am in a tizzy, Smoop said. Oh no, Woogums said, not a tizzy. Tomorrow is the Big Wig Parade, Smoop said, and I don't have a wig. Wait a minute, Woogums said. I don't have a wig yet either. Now they both were in a tizzy. Not only that, Woogums said, the winner gets to be Grand Wig Marshal and lead the parade. It was looking like it was going to be a sad, sad, super sad, wigless parade. Sniff, 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 Smoops said. Did someone leave a mayonnaise sandwich in the sun? Maybe it's the smell of our sad, sad, super sad, wigless despair, Woogums said. They were both wrong. It was Pelty. It's another dog. Hey, guys, Pelty said. Why the tizzy? Isn't it obvious? Smoops asked. We don't have wigs for the parade. I'm not going to bother, Pelty said. Last year, they made me walk behind the parade. Well, you are pretty stinky, Smoop said, and you shed fur all the time and everywhere. Face it, Pelty, you're a scuzzy bunny. Woogum said. Yeah, I guess so, Pelty said. Back to the wig search, Woogums said. Squee! Those feathers would make an awesome wig. You are so lovely, I can barely contain myself, Woogum said, but something smells like turkey pots. And it is a turkey. Am I lovely? Smoops asked. I beg your pardon, the turkey said. I had a mayonnaise sandwich for breakfast, and it's not sitting well. Well, that won't work, Woogum said. Guys, I have an idea, Pelty started to say. Wait, look, Woogums interrupted. We could make some wigs out of this sweet clump. Woogums fluffed the clump onto his head. How do I look? He asked. P.U. What is that smell? Smoops asked. It's worse than Pelty. No, it's your new stinky wig pile, Smoops said. Are you sure it's not the smell of despair? Woogums asked. Well, that's not going to work, Woogums said as he unfluffed the clump. What about making a wig out of... Pelty tried to say again. Hello there. Well, it's itty-bitty, Smoop said. What's that delightful perched upon... Delightfulness perched upon your head? And it's a skunk, Woogums asked. It's my wig for the parade, itty-bitty said. Isn't it dandy? Squee, Smoop said. I love it. Sniff, sniff, sniff. Okay, this time I'm definitely smelling despair, Woogum said. That's not despair, and that's not a wig, Smook said. That's a skunk. Ah, itty bitty said. Well, that's not going to work, Woogum said. This is going to be the saddest, sad, super sad, wigless parade ever, Woogum said. Hush, Smoop said. We are trying to wallow in our wigglessness. Guys, look, I've got, Pelty said. Guys, Pelty shouted, for wig's sake, listen to me. What? And now he's got something else in his hand. You could use my fur, Pelty said. This has the smell of a movie star written all over it, Smoop said. Wow, it's so greasy you can smoosh it into any shape, Itty Bitty said. This is going to work, Woogum said. The solution had been right under their noses the whole time. The next day, the parade was underway. There are all the animals. I feel so glamorous and fashionable, Itty Bitty said. Squee! It sticks to my head and won't let go, Smoops said. Does anyone smell turkey poots? Woogum said. The end. And the last picture shows the turkey on top of Woop's head. This land, the history of the land we're on. This is my house. I live here with my family. Before us, another family lived here. Before that, another family lived here too. And another. Before our house was here, there was another family with a different kind of house, a wigwam. There was a whole village full of families laughing, cooking, and playing. There were even annoying little brothers. But when people came here from Europe, they forced most of those families to leave their homes. All across the country, Native Americans had to leave everything they knew and move onto small pieces of land called reservations. But despite everything done to them, many Native American people still live in my city today, like my friend TJ. He's Anishinaabe, and he lives with his grandma. TJ's grandma, Noko, taught me that before my ancestors arrived, this land was filled with indigenous people from coast to coast. I wonder if all of them made food as good as she does. Noko taught us a song to help us remember that indigenous people have always been here, and they're still here wherever we go. This land is sacred. This land is living. From the Black Hills to Pueblo Canyon, from the swampy bayous to the salmon swimming, this land all has a history. Now, whenever my family goes somewhere, I ask, who lived here before the people who live here now? At the Grand Canyon, I learned that 8 tribes call it home. The Havasupai, Yavapai, Paiute, Hopi, Zuni, Halapai, Apache, and Diné. Their relatives have lived here longer than anyone can remember, even the really old people. At the Golden Gate Bridge, I learned that the Ohoni have been fishing here for thousands of years. In New York City, I learned that the Lenape were here long before all these skyscrapers. Everywhere we go, there are indigenous people to learn from. So I keep singing, this land is sacred, this land is living. This land, all has a history, even my backyard. More about land acknowledgement. All of the United States of America sits on indigenous land. Your home, your school, all of your favorite places, Disney World, it's on Seminole land. The White House, it's on Natchoktank and Piscataway land. Mount Rushmore, it's on Osceshawin land. You can go to the nativeland.ca website and type in your address to see whose land you're on. Why is it important? When we acknowledge territory, we are showing respect for indigenous people, both past and present. And it's important to know and understand our story. Although it can be hard and sad to learn about how indigenous people were treated in the places we live, it is very important for us to do. When we learn about the history of the land we live on, we begin to heal the wounds of our past. But just acknowledging the past is not enough. We have to treat indigenous people and the land they are connected to with dignity and respect. This is good for all of us, whether we are indigenous, black, white, Asian, or Latin, because when we treat each other and the land with respect, we can build a better world together. We can have cleaner water, air, and soil that will allow us and the plants and animals around us to thrive. We'll finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled, Hopefully, the Scarecrow. A scarecrow stood in the garden, tall, proud, smiling. Like most of us, he didn't remember the very beginning of his days. He only knew he was created with loving hands, carefully crafted, wonderfully made. He did remember the first time she placed him on his perch. She set him up straight, stood back, and smiled. Hopefully, the scarecrow will keep the birds away, she'd said. He hadn't known his name was Hopefully, but he liked it. Hopefully, the scarecrow also liked stories. He couldn't read, of course, but she could. Every day, she brought her favorite books to the garden, and she read to him. As she read, the scarecrow journeyed over rocky cliffs and sailed rolling seas and met kings and queens and dragons and other scarecrows. He heard tales of courage and of hope. And when she said the end, the scarecrow always felt a little bit taller and braver. One day, just after the beans withered and the corn stalks turned brown and the air became bitey and brisk, her two sturdy hands lifted him from his perch and placed him carefully in the shed. Hopefully, the scarecrow will be okay in there all winter, she said. He was alone, and the shed was dark, but he was warm and dry. And he didn't worry because she had said it herself. He would be okay during the long, cold winter. Besides, he had all her stories nestled deep in the straw beneath his hat to keep him company. Finally, when the scarecrow heard the birds return from the south and daylight lingered past dinner time and the air smelled fresh and green, the thin crack of door light widened and he was once again returned to the garden. Year after year she came and she read to him. As the books got bigger, the stories got scarier and funnier and sweeter. And year after year, just after the beans withered and the corn stalks turned brown and the air became crisp and brisk, her two sturdy hands would lift him from his perch and place him carefully in the shed. Hopefully, I'll see you in the spring, he heard her say one fall, just before she closed the door. That next spring, after the scarecrow heard the birds return from the south, and daylight lingered past dinner time, and the air smelled fresh and green, the thin crack of door light widened, and two different hands placed him in the garden, where he, hopefully, waited. After all, she had said she'd see him in the spring. But she didn't come to read to him. The next day, a soaking rain made the scarecrow's flannel droop, and thunder shook the ground beneath his wobbly legs. But he was not discouraged. Day after day, the summer sun glared, and soon the scarecrow's smile started to fade. Once, a mean wind shoved him sideways and took his hat far away. Still, she did not come, and the scarecrow was lonely. Her stories filled his head, and he remembered that to journey over rocky cliffs and sail rolling seas and face monsters, one must be brave. So he, hopefully, waited for a very long time until one day, two familiar hands straightened his perch and smoothed his weathered shirt. Oh, my, look at you, she said. Hopefully, I can fix this. With some patches, a dab of paint, and a new straw hat, the scarecrow's smile brightened. He wondered if she'd brought new stories, but her hands were empty, and when she lifted him, perch and all, from the garden, the scarecrow was confused, but not afraid. They were going somewhere together. Now they're at the library. Hopefully, the scarecrow will love it here, just outside of the library, he heard her say, and he knew she was right. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading a novel that I just started last week titled Jack's New Power: Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is the summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida, but even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by misadventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe, discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father, and has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in these eight fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. Last week, after saving a couple from drowning in the ocean off of their hotel, Jack's dad asked him and his sister Betsy and younger brother Pete what their greatest fears were. Jack said horses, Pete said water because he couldn't swim, and Betsy said the British royal couple finding out after calling them that their family was basically a family of nobodies. And that's where I left off last week. Betsy, Dad said, let's hear it. Okay, she replied. She had used the time to organize exactly what was on her mind. I'm afraid I'll call the number on this cable and they'll ask me who I am and who I know and who were my ancestors, and I tell them, we are the Henry family, and they'll reply, Henry, are you servants? We don't recall any Henry family. And they'll hang up because we are a bunch of nobodies. There was a long pause while Dad leaned back in his chair. He gazed up at the ceiling and breathed deeply, then more deeply. It seemed as though all the air in the room, the curtains, the tablecloth corners, the little table flowers, all nodded toward his flaring nostrils. After a moment, he exhaled and looked Betsy directly in the eyes. We are not a bunch of nobodies, he said. I know we're starting over here, and we don't have some long family history filled with snotty blue bloods. But that's not what is important. We are a family at the beginning of greatness. All those British royalty had to come from nowhere. At some point, they were living in caves, wearing animal skins, and beating each other with sticks. So, big deal. They've had a head start on us. Now they're at the butt end of their empire, and we are at the beginning of ours. And for my money, I'd rather be a part of something new and great than be some royal has-been. Honey, Mom whispered, keep your voice down. We don't want to cause a scene. There were a lot of British guests at the hotel. Betsy lowered her head. She had taken it too far. There were times when she could beat him in an argument, but there were also times when he reared back and let her have it. He had just nailed her. So, he said, wrapping up his point, you can face your fear and give them a call. I felt like an idiot for revealing my fear of horses. A call would be easy to make. I should have said I had a fear of something like spending money. Then Dad could give me a bundle and let me face my fear by letting me go on a shopping spree. He turned toward Mom. She put on a cheerful face and saved the mood of of the dinner. "No doubt about it," she said. "Driving a car is my greatest fear, and now with a baby, I'll be trapped if I don't learn to drive." Dad nodded. "Very good," he said with a jolly voice. "I'll get you a car and lessons." "What about the baby?" I asked. "Well, he's exempt until he's 3, Dad replied. "Then he has to join the rat race like the rest of us." He propped his elbows on the table and narrowed his eyes. "We'll start tomorrow." But Betsy wasn't finished. "What's your fear?" she asked, still trying to corner him. "Everyone has something they're afraid of, even you." He tucked in his chin and stared out at us. "My fear," he said, "is that you all will let me down." In the morning, Dad came into our room. He woke Pete and me. "I've been thinking how to conquer fear," he said. "It's a combination of dread and encouragement." "Jack," he ordered, "you'll help Pete build up his confidence today. Give him some early lessons. Show him how you swim. All he needs is encouragement." "Okay," I replied. I looked over at Pete and gave him our brothers for life wink. "I'll provide the dread," Dad said, and sat down on the corner of the bed. "Listen to this. I knew a man once who was a great big guy, huge, big arms, big legs, all muscle and not afraid of a thing. But his son was afraid of the water. Couldn't get near the stuff without shaking all over like a girl. The father tried everything to teach the boy about the water, YMCA swim lessons, swim camp, the whole thing. Finally, he got frustrated. He picked up the boy and put him in a speedboat and roared off into the harbor. He pulled up to a buoy and set the boy on the little floating platform. You'll either swim in or you'll starve to death out here. He growled and roared off. And you know what? Dad paused. He starved? Whispered Pete, with his face all white and his hand over his eyes as he imagined the boy on the buoy. Dad grabbed Pete by the head and gave him an Indian rub with his unshaven chin. Then he let him loose. No, knucklehead. The boy swam to shore. He could swim all along. He was just being stubborn. But I'm afraid, Pete said. Dad had reached his limit. He stood up. Jack, we'll help you swim, just as you'll help him with his fear of horses. Then he left. Pete dropped onto the floor and peeked up at me like a kitten about to be drowned. I'll help you, I said. We can't let him down. And I'll help you with the horses, he replied. I'm not so scared of them. After breakfast, I wanted to get started, but Pete refused. You can't swim on a full stomach, he said. Let's do the horses first. He was right. Okay, but let's just get it over with. Horseback riding was advertised in the hotel brochure. There were stables and long horse trails cut through the brush and trees on the land side of the hotel. We had started down the footpath to the stables when Pete said, Stop! I have to tell you a story of dread before I give you encouragement. I have enough dread, I said, groaning. We have to play by the rules. Pete sat down on the path. I won't help unless you listen. I sat next to him. So once there was a boy named Alexander. His father owned a huge horse, and everyone who tried to ride it was thrown off and killed. Alexander's father said that if anyone could tame the horse, they could have it. Everyone who had tried to ride the horse faced it toward the sun. So Alexander faced the horse away from the sun. Then he jumped on the horse and rode away. When the father saw what he had done, he gave him the horse and called him Alexander the Great. I glared at Pete. You're scaring me because I can't figure out what you mean, I said. Where's the dread? I mean, that if you use your brains, you can win. Horses aren't very smart. They don't need brains, I said. They're killers. We walked down to the stable. A short, heavy man named Mr. Doobie cared for the horses. I figured he was an old jockey who'd retired to eating. "Well, I got a nice one," he muttered and pointed to a dark, nervous giant. Its eyes were like polished stones. "He used to be a racehorse at the track down below until his accident." He pointed at a 2-foot jagged scar running down the animal's neck. "Well, he can be a little bit moody if he don't sleep well. He still has nightmares of that picket fence." I hoped he'd had a good night's sleep. His name was Winnie, and he was wearing a Western saddle, which I liked because it would give me something to hang on to. Still, as soon as I got close to Winnie, my fear of him made me weak. When he shuddered and waved his big head from side to side and snorted, I jumped back a few steps. His hind leg twitched, and I was sure he wanted to kick me into the water trough. Pete wasn't impressed. "Horses know when you are afraid of them. Just treat them like big dogs." Finally, he had said something dreadful. I also had a huge fear of big dogs. "Are you afraid of riding horses?" Pete asked. "No, I'm more afraid of being kicked in the head," I said. "Then let's conquer your greatest fear, like Dad said. If you get over being kicked, then riding them will be a breeze." He took the bridle and walked the horse down the path and away from the sun. I waited until he had gone about 20 feet before I followed. When he stopped, I stopped. "Come here," Pete said. He pulled his t-shirt up over his head. "Tie this around your eyes." I did. "Give me your hand." I held it out. He clutched it and pulled me along. I hadn't covered my ears very well and heard the horse pawing the ground and shuddering. "Now stand here," he said. I stood as stiff as a pillar. With each breath, I smelled the horse and figured it smelled my fear. I felt the ground move as it trampled up and down. I could sense it was lining me up for a world-class kick. I gritted my teeth and waited for the blow. "Reach your left hand straight out," Pete ordered. I did. I touched the horse and instinctively pulled back. "Just do what I say and you'll be fine. Now stick out your hand." I extended it slowly. I felt horsehair and the roundness of his rump. I lifted my hand just so it hovered over the horse. I didn't want to disturb it. "Move your hand down until you feel the tail," Pete ordered. Slowly, I lowered my hand until I felt the long, coarse hairs. "Now gently grab the tail," I did. "Now give it a little tug," I froze. "Just a little tug," he insisted. "Then you won't have to do any more, and I'll tell Dad you conquered your fear." I took a deep breath and yanked the tail as though I were pulling a bell rope. The horse kicked me so viciously in the thigh that I skipped along the ground, staggered up the dirt path, and collapsed sideways into the bushes. The horse galloped off as I reached up with my free arm and jerked the shirt over my head. Pete was laughing so hard he had dropped onto his knees. When he saw me staring at him, I stood up and backed away. "I'll kill you. I'll murder you," I shouted. "No, I won't murder you. I'll drown you. I'll make you go deep sea diving without a hose. You'll do more than face your fear. You'll face your maker." "I was just trying to help," he cried. "You faced your fear and you survived. It wasn't that bad." I may have survived, but my fear had multiplied. I untangled myself from the bush and put all my weight on my leg. It held. It wasn't broken, but it throbbed. I undid my belt and dropped my pants. There was a red horseshoe-shaped bruise glowing on my swollen thigh. I could even see where the nail heads had made little circles on my skin. The horse had branded me. It owned me. I pulled my pants up. "You're dead," I said, and began to limp up the path. "Just return the horse to the stable before I drown you." I needed to lie down. Pete didn't wait for me to drown him. After I rested my leg, I put on my bathing suit and went down to the pool. He was in the shallow end with a styrofoam bubble strapped to his back and little plastic water wings on his arms. He couldn't sink if I sat on him. "Hey," I said, "you're doing great." He turned and smiled up at me. "Thanks," he sputtered and thrashed his arms around. "I was so afraid you'd drown me, I started without you." Dad was right. Fear of one thing can really get a person to face the fear of another thing altogether. I stepped into the water and waded it over to him. "Okay," I instructed, "I'll hold you up as you swim from side to side, but first you have to take off the water wings." "No, I keep the bubble on," he insisted. "Okay." "Sorry about the horse," he said. "I was just doing my best." "Oh, you'll notice," I said, "that I am not asking you to practice in the deep end. What you did to me was like pushing a blind man into traffic so he could get over his fear of cars. Now, let's go." I held him under the belly as he began to swim the crawl, with his legs kicking and his arms flailing. Then I unsnapped the clip on his bubble and stepped away. "Excuse me," I shouted above his splashing, "I forgot to tell you a story of dread." "Once upon a time, there was a demented older brother with a horseshoe branded on his leg." He finally noticed he was alone. "Help," he gurgled. "You need help holding your breath?" I asked, and pushed him under. I counted to three, then hauled him up. "Help! Who is the boss?" I asked. "You are." "Who is the master?" "You are." I led him over to the edge. "Tomorrow, I'll teach you the fine points of swimming," I said. He grabbed the edge of the pool and held on. Now he had plenty of dread. When we sat down to dinner, everyone seemed to be smiling except for me. "Well," Dad started, "well, I didn't tell you this last night. I didn't want to jinx myself by talking about it. But I was afraid that my bid on a hotel reservation might not be accepted. I thought I had bid too high. And without that job, I would have let all of you down. But I found out this morning that the bid was accepted. And I'll be working close to where we'll be living on the other side of the island. The job is good for at least half a year." Mom leaned over and gave him a kiss. "Congratulations, honey," she said. He beamed. Pete was next. "I did some swimming," he blurted out.
"Good work, son," Dad replied. "I knew I wouldn't have to drop you off on a buoy."
"And I did some driving," Mom chirped and nodded approvingly at herself. "But you've always been terrified of driving," I said. I was really counting on her not to face her fear. "And the drivers here are insane." "Oh, I know. But your dad told me a little story that really hit home."
"What's that?" I asked. Mom glanced at Dad. "No, you tell him," Dad replied and nodded.
"Well, it was back in Fort Lauderdale. There was a woman who had a baby that was choking on a leaf. She couldn't unblock the baby's throat. There was a second car in the garage, but she didn't know how to drive. She called the fire department, but they couldn't get there right away. The hospital was only about 10 blocks down the road, and so, in a panic, she grabbed the baby and began to run. But the baby died in her arms just as she reached the emergency room doors. If she had known how to drive, she would have saved that baby's life. When your dad reminded me of that story, I knew I couldn't let something like that happen to any of you kids. So I got in one of the staff cars with the chef, and we practiced driving in a straight line up and down the service road."
"Very impressive,"
Betsy said, and clapped politely. And believe it or not, even I have something to report. What? I spit out. What? I could feel the world slowly closing in on me and my horse fear. I was going to be the only loser. Well, before I tell you, I want to apologize to Dad for talking the way I did last night. I was wrong to be so critical of us all. What was wrong with her? She must have been turned into a zombie overnight. She never apologized for anything in her life. Never. Well, it happens to the best of them, Dad said with a chuckle. Now, what's your news? Well, after that little story you told me, she said, nodding toward Dad, I faced my fear. I called the British couple you saved and told them who I was. And they were really nice. They said you were a hero, and they told all their close friends about this great American man who saved them, and they apologized over and over for not thanking you in person. But they weren't supposed to be on Barbados since they told their snoopy families that they were going to Italy because they wanted some privacy from the hundreds of royal relatives that would want to join them on their honeymoon. See, Dad said proudly, if you hadn't called, you wouldn't have known the truth of the matter. What story did you tell Betsy to get her going? I asked. Dad smiled at Betsy. She turned toward me. Dad told me about his older sister who had a big crush on a man named Harvey Jacobs from the rich side of town. She never told him she liked him because she was from the poor side of the tracks. She ended up marrying someone she didn't like as much. After the wedding, her new husband said to her, Boy, I feel lucky to be married to you because Harvey Jacobs had been in love with you forever. So if she had the courage to call Harvey Jacobs and tell him how she felt, she would be with her true love and not with some yokel she settled for. The lesson is, if you don't have the guts to ask, you'll never find out what people think of you. I'll never have to read another book for the rest of my life, I thought. I just have to hang around Dad all day, and I'll hear a story on every subject known to man. But where was mine, I wondered. What could he possibly tell me that would get me over my horse fear? Then very slowly, I could feel everyone turning their eyes on me. Jack, do you have anything to tell us about your day? Dad asked. I looked at Pete. He was sucking on a lime wedge. He had a story to tell, but he kept it to himself. Well, can I talk to you about this later? I asked. I'm not feeling well. Certainly, Mom said. I pushed my chair back and limped out of there as quickly as I could. I went to my room and sat on my bed. I imagined our coat of arms, which would be passed down to future generations. There will be a picture of Mom driving a car. Under the picture will be the word bravery. Dad will be painted standing on top of a pile of money that spells out the word success. Betsy will be wearing a little royal crown, and under the picture will be courage. Pete will be pictured leaping off a high diving board above the word fearless. Then there will be me. I'll be shown being trampled by a horse above the words, weak, weak link. I stood up and looked into the mirror. I wanted to scare myself, weak link. I jeered at my reflection, weak link. After a moment, my reflection wind back. I can live with that. Just then, Dad came into the room. After you left the table, Pete told us he tried to give you some encouragement. Said it didn't work. Yeah, it backfired, I said. Well, I could tell you a story that would point out how facing your horse fears would make you a better man. But instead of making up a story, I'd just rather tell you the truth.
He sat down and draped his arm across my shoulders. I had a feeling that the truth was going to be scarier than a story. Simply put, he stated, you can't fail. I won't allow it. You are named after me. If you fail, it's like me failing. If I hadn't saved that couple, I wouldn't be able to look you in the eyes. If you can't ride that horse, you wouldn't be able to look me in the eyes. And a son that can't look his father in the eyes is a coward. And if we can't look each other in the eyes, we will go through life like strangers. Well, I'll try my best, I said. I've got great faith that there will be a happy ending to this story, he said. If you get weak-kneed, just think of me diving into the ocean. It takes courage to be a man. He slapped me on my swollen thigh, stood up, and left the room. When I woke up the next morning, I didn't even open my eyes. I could hear the wind and rain beating against the windows. It was a day to avoid horses. It was a day to avoid Dad's eyes. It was a day to avoid mirrors. I opened my bedside drawer and pulled out my diary. I held it up to the key around my neck and unlocked it. One of the big differences between me and Dad was that he talked all his stories out. I wrote mine down. But since arriving in Barbados, I hadn't written a word. This was a good day to get caught up. I started with the story of the German girls drowning. Then I wrote about Dad being a hero. I wrote down everyone's fears. Then I wrote Dad's stories about the boy on the boy, the choking baby, and the woman who settled for the wrong man. But there was one story that wasn't his. It was mine. I wrote the first half of my horse story. The ending would have to wait until I had lived it. Suddenly, I was starved. I had skipped breakfast, but was ready for lunch. I went down to the dining room. Pete was eating a club sandwich and French fries. I sat next to him and picked off his plate. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.